Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this issue, which focuses on estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer, I met with Dr. Matthew Goetz, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
She presented with a palpable mass and had appropriate workup at that time. Apart from the palpable breast mass, she was asymptomatic, and she was found to have a locally advanced breast cancer. Estrogen receptor was strongly positive, HER2 was negative. And of course, given the locally advanced nature of the tumor, she did have staging workup that showed evidence for multiple skeletal metastases.
Did you have any sense for whether this is just the biology of disease or had she delayed seeking care?
Actually, this particular individual was someone who was very much attuned into her health. She was actually, I would call her perhaps even a health nut. She exercised regularly. She was somebody clearly who did not delay seeking attention. So this was something that we would call truly de novo stage four, somebody presenting at the time with disease both simultaneously in the breast and systemically as well.
Before we start to kind of get into the clinical research that relates to this kind of case, any thoughts about what it was like kind of dealing with this woman who's so health avid now has metastatic disease?
Well, I think this is, of course, a huge issue because, first of all, being a young woman who has so many different things that she's dealing with, her career, her young family, young children, knowing that she's done everything possible up until this point to take care of herself. And by the way, I didn't mention this, but there was no family history of breast cancer, and the genetic workup that we did was negative. So there was clearly a lot of unanswered questions for this individual. And so moving through the diagnosis and going from I have breast cancer to it's stage four was obviously in light of her family and everything else was obviously a very difficult situation.
You know, any thoughts? Our group has had an interest for a long time in the issue of the minor children and grandchildren of patients with cancer, particularly those with incurable cancer. And I've been kind of disappointed about the lack of national support. A lot of research centers will have, you know, counseling, et cetera. Any thoughts about how you approach this and how your team approaches it?
Well, I think one of the things that's important up front, of course, is when we see a patient with stage four disease, is to provide as much information as we can about the biology, about what the prognosis is, and there needs to be some realism so that they can plan. I think probably the worst case scenario is a situation where the patient doesn't completely understand the prognosis and is not able to prepare. And I think especially for individuals with young children, you want to be able to, if you will, you have an opportunity, whether that survival is 3 years or 2 years or 5 or 10 years, you have an opportunity to leave a legacy and to impart that upon your children, upon your family. So I think it's critically important that clinicians, social workers, et cetera, provide that support that allow those patients and their families to know realistically what's going on. But of course, we have to provide hope. And that good news is, of course, is there's been a lot of advances that really have improved the outcomes of these patients.
So maybe you can talk a little bit about the options that a woman in this situation might be considering or you might be considering. And also, you mentioned she had locally advanced disease. Were you concerned about losing local control?
Well, I think that's a really good point. And certainly it's one of the things that we think about in these patients where we are thinking about systemic therapy. And this really gets into the issue of how confident are we are our therapy is going to work. In this situation, from the start, it appeared this woman had a truly estrogen-dependent tumor, at least on the face from what we could see, and that if we were able to provide adequate systemic therapy, that we should be able to achieve both local as well as distant systemic control.
So maybe you can talk about, from your point of view, what were the options that were considered and what you ended up treating her with?
Well, I think things certainly have evolved, especially over the past, even the last 5 years for the treatment of a metastatic ER-positive breast cancer. And certainly now with the data from Mona Lisa 7 with regard to the treatment of premenopausal patients. But I think in general, the point has been, of course, is that in the metastatic setting, we've treated women with ER-positive breast cancer much like we have in the metastatic setting, and that is to adequately suppress estrogen. And that really means in the premenopausal setting, both a drug like doxycycline or oophorectomy along with an aromatase inhibitor really gives the best outcomes. And I think in this situation in 2016, the question that we were faced was, should we additionally give a CDK4/6 inhibitor given the emerging data in the postmenopausal setting?
You know, one of the issues I'm curious about, you mentioned the doxycycline, and I hear about this fairly frequently, is concerns that physicians in practice have about whether it's adequate ovarian suppression and how to determine that and how often it can actually be a problem.
So this is a really important point, and I don't think we completely know the answer. If we were to look at data in the postmenopausal setting where we give aromatase inhibitors routinely, there are emerging data and data that will be presented at some upcoming meetings looking at this question of these levels of estradiol and how well one suppresses that and whether that actually is associated with outcomes. In premenopausal women, we have very few data. And I think clinicians rightfully in this situation are thinking about this in the correct manner. What we do need to know is, are we adequately suppressing the ligand? And if that is important, we think it is important, should we be measuring it? Right now, we don't measure it on a routine basis, but certainly we've all experienced patients in our practice that for whatever reason did not have adequate ovarian function suppression, and we've perhaps gone on to do different things such as oophorectomy or other measures to try to deal with that.
What about with this woman? Did you bring up surgical oophorectomy with her?
Actually, I did. And what we decided at the time of the consultation was that we would get going with the doxycycline. That's an easy thing to start with. It's also, I like to start with doxycycline for my patients because it allows them, if you will, to be able to get used to the effects of ovarian function suppression and to know perhaps after a couple months that it is tolerable, which it is for most patients in this situation. And then they're quite willing to move right into oophorectomy. Occasionally, I'll have patients who say, hey, I just want to move right into oophorectomy. And of course, as we know, that can take anywhere from a few days to weeks to get that scheduled surgically.
So she had doxycycline, and I see she also had letrozole and palbo, certainly a common choice. How did she physically feel once she got on the therapy?
Well, this is a case of a patient who actually tolerated the therapy beautifully. She was able to take the medication and really have very minimal, if any, side effects. Now, this particular patient, as I mentioned, was someone who was working out regularly. She was running anywhere from 1 to 2 miles a day. And she did mention to me that she had some fatigue, but she described it as being very mild and really not interfering with her activities of daily living.
That's interesting. Do you find that patients who exercise tolerate these agents better?
I think that there clearly is. In general, we see that patients who are metabolically fit can oftentimes do better with therapies, which we know have a lot of effects on a variety of different organ function, certainly in this situation. And I know clinicians would feel the same way, is that if you have a patient with an ECOG performance status of 0 and is doing all their activities of daily living, that they're going to do much better than those patients that have multiple comorbidities and are starting out with difficulties as it relates to fatigue or other side effects from their chronic medical illnesses.
So it's interesting. You may know that we are always asking people, both investigators as well as docs in practice, what they do in various situations. We did a big survey where we presented all kinds of scenarios, ER-positive, HER2-negative, metastatic disease. And I was kind of surprised, particularly in patients who present with metastatic disease, that a substantial minority do not use a CDK inhibitor. And if we throw in 1 or 2 liver mets, you'll start seeing a lot of chemotherapy also. Can you kind of talk from a broad point of view before we get into the specific agents about these kinds of questions? Are there patients where you, quote, don't need a CDK inhibitor? And what would it take to use chemotherapy?
So these are obviously important questions. And I think as we are beginning to see more and more data about the CDK4/6 inhibitors and their efficacy, we're beginning to see survival data. I think it's beginning to be harder and harder to find patients, let's say, that we should be omitting CDK4/6 inhibitors. Now, that being said, we've all seen patients in our clinic who are known to have hormonally driven cancers. A patient perhaps has a long disease-free interval from the time that she was originally diagnosed and, let's say, completed her adjuvant hormonal therapy, who presents perhaps with minimally symptomatic disease. We can think about these patients and know that it's probably not unreasonable to treat these patients with hormonal general, let's say, monotherapy, an AI. But in general, as these data emerge showing clear evidence for now survival advantage, we see, for example, data that we can prolong the time to chemotherapy. And these are important endpoints, clearly, for patients. And I think as we begin to see these data more and more, it's going to be more and more difficult to find these patients, let's say, that should be treated with just endocrine monotherapy.
Another thing that I recall from that survey that was interesting is, again, we started to see a tail off in use of CDK inhibitors in older patients, particularly 80 plus. Any justification for that?
So this is a thing where a lot of clinicians really do think about tolerability. We know that as a person ages, their organ function changes, their ability to metabolize drugs changes. And so rightfully, I think clinicians are cautious in this situation. I think what we can say in this situation is that when people have looked very carefully thus far at elderly patients, they seem to tolerate the CDK4/6 inhibitors well. And specifically, I'm thinking about palbociclib. And despite the fact that we do see neutropenia, and of course, all of us as clinicians, when we first saw the data with CDK4/6 inhibitors, when we saw neutropenia, we thought about, oh my gosh, this is going to be chemotherapy-like neutropenia, but really it is quite a bit different. And I think what we can say is that the elderly can do well, they can tolerate CDK4/6 inhibitors, and they clearly can gain benefit from them.
Just to start with the basics, can you go back through your vision of, you know, how you explain to your fellows basically of how these agents work?
Well, when I think about these agents, and first of all, stepping back, when we think about ER-positive breast cancer and knowing a little bit about how breast cancer cells utilize the estrogen receptor to grow, we, of course, know that blocking the estrogen receptor or controlling the ligand with aromatase inhibitors is a quite effective treatment, but that with long-term treatment, there can be resistance that develops. Now, the mechanisms of resistance that we know are quite diverse, both de novo as well as acquired resistance. And one of the things about CDK4/6 inhibitors is that the CDK4/6 is a critical aspect that interacts with cyclin D. And cyclin D is a major transcriptional, if you will, gene that is regulated by estrogen receptor, but it's also importantly regulated by a number of different pathways. And so if we think about why, for example, people have observed the fact that CDK4/6 inhibitors have activity in HER2-positive breast cancer, again, it's because some of those same pathways downstream actually also target cyclin D1. And so these pathways emerge on CDK4 and 6 and cyclin D. And because of that, there is an ability to potentially deal with resistance that occurred both de novo, by the way, as well as acquired. One of the things, of course, that we've all been quite interested with CDK4/6 inhibitors is this question of ESR1 mutations, which, as we are hearing, is a major mechanism of resistance to, for example, aromatase inhibitors. And again, knowing that the cyclin D1 is downstream of the estrogen receptor, despite the fact that the receptor is mutated, we have the ability, if you will, to rescue that particular cancer cell by inhibiting the proliferation and inhibiting this common pathway, that is CDK4/6 and cyclin D ultimately going through and affecting the cell cycle.
How do you bring in mTOR inhibitors and PI3 kinase inhibitors into this kind of biologic model?
Well, I think in this situation, what we have is really a question of, with CDK4 and 6, two aspects. Number one is, what are the mechanisms of resistance to CDK4/6? And if one of those mechanisms perhaps is activation of the PI3 kinase AKT pathway, that perhaps it would make sense to start thinking about combination therapies. And in fact, there are preclinical data. Those data do suggest that that pathway is important, and that actually doing studies where you combine with mTOR inhibitors or PI3 kinase inhibitors may make sense. I think we get into that age-old question, which we've always had, and that is, can you combine therapies and will it be tolerable? Because now all of a sudden you bring in different pathways, different side effects. And indeed, when people have looked at the so-called triple therapy, and we did a study at the clinic where we used a TORC1, TORC2 inhibitor, along with targeting the estrogen receptor, along with CDK4/6, in general, you're seeing more side effects. And for a lot of patients, this is just not going to be tolerable. So then we get back into this question of, is it best to probably do sequential therapies? And is there a subset of patients where absolutely we should be thinking of triplet therapy? And I think for right now, I see it more of sequential. It's a great idea. I think scientifically it makes sense. clinically, we haven't been able to achieve bringing in multiple drugs and doing so-called triplet combinations without substantial toxicities.
You mentioned ESR1 mutations. Can you talk a little bit about exactly how that works and in terms of what the result is? You know, you hear you can use fulvestrant or agents like that, but not ligand-removing agents like AIs. What's the biology of that?
So this is, of course, an area that has really just, if you will, exploded in the last 5 years. Suzanne Fuqua did some very important research on this many, many years ago, actually more than 20 years ago. And at the time, it was actually observed that these ESR1 mutations do confer resistance in the laboratory to endocrine therapy. But it was really felt that these ESR1 mutations were not really observed in patient samples. So the field did not really move forward. And it was really because of the advent of next generation sequencing that people really started seeing these mutations. And what they saw was that they were emerging in metastatic disease, and they were emerging really in patients that have so-called acquired resistance. So if you long-term estrogen deprive a cancer cell, in this case, using specifically aromatase inhibitors, the observations were that these clones could emerge. And these clones, what am I talking about? They are mutations in the estrogen receptor gene. They confer resistance, and these mutations essentially turn on the estrogen receptor. They cause it to signal, despite the fact that the ligand perhaps is removed, in this case with an aromatase inhibitor. So these ESR1 mutations are a problem because now, as a clinician, we use a medication, we're effectively getting rid of the ligand, but despite the fact that we removed the ligand, the cancer cell and the estrogen receptor is still signaling. It's still on. And so if we think about strategies that would potentially target these mutations, one strategy, of course, is simply get rid of the receptor completely. And that has been really shown already that fulvestrant seems to have activity in patients with ESR1 mutations. But if you look at the data, one of the problems with fulvestrant is really more of a drug delivery issue. You can't give enough of the drug in patients in an intramuscular buttock shot to actually completely and totally degrade the receptor. In fact, you know, at the concentrations that are achieved in the laboratory, fulvestrant is one of the best drugs we've ever used. But in patients, we just don't get enough fulvestrant in to achieve optimal estrogen receptor degradation. So that really has prompted a lot of focus on developing new drugs that target the estrogen receptor. We call them next generation SERDs. And what's really exciting about this, Neil, is the fact that there are a number of companies that have these drugs. They effectively target the receptor for degradation. And we're seeing data both preclinically in ESR1 mutant models where these drugs work, but also we're seeing clinical data. And so I think we're very excited to move these drugs into the clinic and to see if they can be a step forward for treating ESR1 mutant breast cancers. Now, another approach is actually to use a SERM. And so our group has studied the drug endoxifen for a while, and we have a randomized clinical trial that we'll read out later this year comparing endoxifen with tamoxifen. And when we published our data a few years ago in Journal of Clinical Oncology, we showed that endoxifen had anti-tumor activity in ESR1 mutant tumors. Similarly, there is another drug called lasofoxifene. And if you've been in breast cancer for a while, you'll think, well, lasofoxifene, that's an old drug. And indeed, it was developed years ago. And lasofoxifene is a drug in the PEARL study, which was a study that was evaluating women at risk for osteoporosis or perhaps who had vulval vaginal issues. Lasofoxifene in that study as a secondary endpoint reduced breast cancer by over 80%. It was not taken forward, but recently has been picked up by another company, and there's renewed interest, and specifically because there's data that lasofoxifene fits into the estrogen receptor and specifically causes distortion in such a way that in these ESR1 mutant models can actually inhibit ER transcription and proliferation, and perhaps even better than the drug fulvestrant. So there's a study ongoing with lasofoxifene specifically in these ESR1 mutants. So I would say there's an explosion of studies specifically looking at this very critical mechanism resistance which is ESR1 mutations.
So getting back to this patient, you chose to give her, in addition to ovarian suppression, letrozole and palbo. And I think that would really give us an introduction into the issue of what we know about, A, the choice of upfront endocrine therapy to start with, because you mentioned fulvestrant. There have been trials really in the pre-CDK era where fulvestrant and an AI was used, or fulvestrant. And then, of course, the issue of choosing a CDK inhibitor, specifically in a premenopausal woman. So maybe you can kind of go through an overview of what we know about really the three CDK inhibitors that are approved right now.
Well, it's a remarkable time, Neil, because we have three CDK4/6 inhibitors, as you said, that are approved, and they've all shown efficacy. And remarkably, they actually have different tolerability profiles. Now, palbociclib and ribociclib appear to have quite similar tolerability profiles, and perhaps ribociclib has a few additional differences than palbociclib. Abemaciclib stands out as being quite a different drug, different not only in terms of its effect on CDK4 and 6, more potent towards CDK4, the fact that abemaciclib is dosed continuously as opposed to discontinuously, but also abemaciclib different in obviously the tolerability profile or the side effect profile. So the side effect we see, of course, with these drugs across the board is neutropenia. And in fact, this was really the defining side effect that concerned most clinicians when these drugs first came on board. And as we've all gotten used to taking them, we realize that the neutropenia that we see is something that can be dealt with, and it's really rarely associated with substantial problems related to infections. If we think about another class effect, I think what we're seeing is fatigue is clearly a class effect. We might see a little bit more alopecia with these drugs, although that is not a predominant side effect for the most part. When we think about abemaciclib, we see less cytopenias, so we see fewer problems with neutropenia, and diarrhea appears to be the predominant side effect of abemaciclib. And most of the studies that have been done more recently have really focused on utilizing a more aggressive anti-diarrheal regimen to deal with the diarrheal side effects of abemaciclib. So I think if we look across these drugs, clearly they are different and different side effects. But also, I think one of the things that we can say is that we can use information about the side effects to help individualize therapy. So for example, I've started some patients on CDK4/6 inhibitors, and they've had profound neutropenia despite multiple dose reductions, and we're actually unable to keep them on the drug. Now, that's unusual, but certainly we could all think of patients in our clinic where we've gone down to the 75 milligram dose, you know, days 1 through 21, and still had problems. And I think where clinicians begin to be concerned about this, Neil, is where we have prolonged time off the CDK4/6 because we're worried about this so-called rebound G1S, where we're going to see rebound proliferation. And I think that concern is probably most acute early on. Once patients are on the drugs for a prolonged period of time, one of the observations that has been made both preclinically as well as clinically is that you might get senescence. And so, therefore, there's less critical problems, if you will, if a patient is off the drug, let's say, for, you know, 2 weeks as opposed to 1 week. Nevertheless, I think this is a theoretical advantage of abemaciclib is that we don't have to worry about the cytopenias as much, and we can dose the drug continuously, and there's perhaps theoretically less worry about this rebound effect with growth.
One of the things I've heard mentioned about abemaciclib, I'm curious what you think about it, is the CNS penetration and whether that actually is a clinical consideration.
You know, I think it's an interesting observation. Certainly when we use these drugs in the first line setting, most of our patients, of course, really don't present with CNS metastases. That's not a defining early event. I do think that as we get better about identifying who is at risk for CNS events, then utilizing a drug that has CNS penetration is going to be critical. Right now, the frequency of this is so low, and I just don't think we can necessarily use this, especially in the earlier stages or in the first line setting.
You mentioned also the issue with diarrhea with abemaciclib. I'm curious what you actually do practically. Do you start patients in preemptive medication? Do you just tell them to contact you if they start to have a problem? What do you actually do?
So what I do in my clinic is to make sure that patients are informed about the risk. I give them a prescription for Imodium. I make sure that they're ready to take it. I have not preemptively given it in all my patients because I've frankly had patients who've done that and developed constipation problems. The patients that I think about as being where this could be problematic are those perhaps that had prior problems with diarrhea for whatever reason. Obviously, we're pretty careful not to put patients with inflammatory bowel disease or other chronic conditions on these drugs, but in general, approach to make it available and so that they can use it at the first time of diarrhea seems to work.
Another issue I want to ask you about is the issue of liver metastases, which this patient didn't have. But I was mentioning in the survey, when we put in even a couple of asymptomatic liver mets, all of a sudden we start to see a lot of chemotherapy being used. What do we know about hormonal therapy with CDK in terms of visceral mets and liver mets?
So this has really been a subject of some secondary analyses, and we reported first at San Antonio a couple years ago and then published data with regard to what were the critical, if you will, important prognostic factors associated with outcomes in the control arms. And control arms here in both MONARCH 2 and MONARCH 3, speaking about either fulvestrant alone or the AI alone. And what really came out of that was really data that we've already known for some time, but really provided with much more granularity the fact that patients with liver metastases do very poorly with endocrine monotherapy. And this is where the data with regard to abemaciclib showed substantial benefit, both in terms of improving response rates that approached actually up to 60%, as well as more than doubling progression-free survival. And by the way, I think both the studies with regard to palbociclib as well as ribociclib again have shown benefit in patients with visceral metastases. So what we can say, Neil, in this situation is that perhaps in the past where we would say liver metastases, oh my gosh, I need to go directly to chemotherapy, I think that what we can say is that in those patients that are relatively asymptomatic, have a disease with little or no synthetic problem as it relates to their liver function, that a CDK4/6 such as abemaciclib really leads to response rates that probably are comparable to single agent chemotherapy or even some of the doublet chemotherapies that we used years ago. And I think that's obviously exciting for patients because, you know, just like I said with this particular patient that I mentioned, you really don't want to be coming back and forth if you can with a new diagnosis and a young family back and forth to the chemotherapy unit if you don't need to. And this has been, in my mind, one of the great advances of the CDK4/6 inhibitors.
You mentioned the response rate with abema being close to 60, but the control, I guess, hormonal therapy alone being only 20%.
Right. And I think, you know, in the past, Neil, as we've given hormonal therapy in the metastatic setting, we certainly have known that there might be certain groups of patients that have, let's say, better or worse outcomes. But these large randomized phase 3 trials have given us the opportunity to really examine more closely what are those factors that are associated with endocrine insensitivity or worse outcomes. And again, with the idea to say that as we get smarter and we can identify these patients up front, we can do hopefully an intervention that's going to lead to better outcomes earlier on.
So you're mentioning the fact that there are three CDK4/6 inhibitors approved. Kind of reminds me a little bit, and there's six checkpoint inhibitors approved right now in oncology. And it kind of seems in general when you have these situations, I've seen people put up slides doing indirect comparisons and saying, well, I'm not supposed to do this, but they all look the same. But then you find people, even if they believe the effects are the same, quote, follow the data. So first of all, do you in your heart feel there's any way to distinguish efficacy? You mentioned toxicity, but efficacy of the three. And when you start to look at the data that we have to work with, you mentioned survival data that's starting to come out, also more data specific to premenopausal. How do you differentiate the available data?
So this is obviously difficult. And as you said, one has to be very cautious because doing these cross-trial comparisons is fraught with issues. I think what we can say, Neil, is that thus far, we have data that these CDK4/6 inhibitors in high-risk populations can improve not just progression-free survival, but overall survival. So let me give you an example. I think what I was most impressed with from the MONALEESA 7 data was that this is a group of patients, that is premenopausal patients, in which really the event rate, and an event rate here are deaths, is actually occurring at a relatively early time point. For example, we don't have data as of yet in the first line palbociclib or the first line ribociclib or first line of abemaciclib with regard to survival, simply because in those patients, we don't have the events. Those patients are doing well. And we've always said, well, you know, is an ER-positive breast cancer that occurs in a premenopausal woman the same as a postmenopausal woman? I think what we can say here is that the benefit of the CDK4/6 inhibitors is not just a progression-free survival benefit, especially in these premenopausal women, but it's a survival benefit. And that benefit is probably occurring because there are more events. This is a more aggressive, if you will, tumor. And again, there's a variety of reasons for that. It could be just the host factors, more estrogen around, so more possibilities of need for additional ways to control proliferation. So I think the Mona Lisa 7 data to me are convincing that these drugs are leading to meaningful improvements in an endpoint that we all agree is survival. We don't have the data as of yet, but there was a press release with regard to abemaciclib showing that abemaciclib in MONARCH 2, and of course MONARCH 2 is the second line setting with fulvestrant, it has improved survival, and we'll wait those data to see that. And of course we have the data from the PALOMA 3, and of course that was this trial that looked at fulvestrant plus palbociclib, published in the New England Journal of Medicine within the last year, showing a survival advantage, at least in the more hormonally sensitive group. And so here's the question, and that question is for clinicians and for me as well, is that which drug should I use? Is there a drug perhaps in a more hormonally sensitive setting that I should be thinking about more than in, let's say, that patient that has 3 liver metastases and would otherwise be considered to have more hormonally insensitive disease? And so those are the issues that I think we're going to need to sort out. It looks to me like these drugs are not the same. I think they all have efficacy, it's no doubt. Clearly different tolerability profiles, but they may have differences in these different settings. That is, a more hormonally sensitive versus a more hormonally insensitive tumors. And so we'll just have to see the data, Neil, as time goes on.
So I want to get your thoughts beyond first-line therapy. Let's come back to your patient. Can you talk about what happened to her tumors as she was treated?
So I think it's quite interesting to me when we see the pace of response to these medications. We can all think about patients in our clinic where we see just this slow response over time. And then I'm thinking about this particular patient where she came back at her first scan. I think it was about 3 months after we first saw her. And her disease, basically her PET scan, showed a complete response to therapy. And in that type of response, of course, those are the patients we love to give that news to. They are gratified. They are in tears. They are excited. Obviously, this has implications for their planning. And this was a case exactly like that, Neil, where it was almost a complete response right away. Interestingly, she had called our nurse probably about 2 weeks after she started the drug, and she said, within 2 weeks, I've noticed already that the tumor within my breast has decreased. And so there was almost an immediate sense by the patient that something good was happening. And obviously, that was confirmed when we got her first scans.
So it is interesting she had this clinical complete response. You know, you hear people say you don't see path CRs when you give neoadjuvant hormonal treatment. But what do we know right now about neoadjuvant hormonal therapy with CDK4/6 inhibition?
Well, what we know, Neil, is that when we treat, obviously, with a drug like tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor, we can inhibit proliferation. And how well you inhibit proliferation has implications long term. We know that in those neoadjuvant studies that have evaluated, for example, abemaciclib or palbociclib, that we inhibit proliferation much better. In fact, proliferation reductions in Ki-67 are sort of, you know, just are substantial. That's the only word I can think of. And so with that in mind, I think the observation and the thought is that given that much inhibition of proliferation, that this certainly should have implications as we think about the adjuvant treatment of ER-positive breast cancer and as we await the outcomes of these trials evaluating CDK4/6 inhibitors in the adjuvant space.
It also makes me think a little bit about how you might have approached this patient if she did not have metastatic disease. Would you have used neoadjuvant chemotherapy? Would you have considered hormonal therapy? I don't know if you'd ever would use a CDK inhibitor outside of a trial in a neoadjuvant setting. Would you have gotten a genomic assay?
I think what I would think about in this situation is to say for, let's say, this particular woman presented with a locally advanced breast cancer, ER-positive, HER2-negative, without metastatic disease, you know, I would really be prompted to think about the data from the SOFT and TEXT trials, knowing that, number one, ovarian function suppression is critical. Number two, knowing that aromatase inhibitor gives you a little bit better outcome. And three, you mentioned the genomic assays. I think certainly what we're hearing now with regard to the use of the genomic assays, especially in premenopausal women, and this, if you will, secondary analysis from Taylor Rx, where it appears that the cut points may be different in premenopausal patients. And does that have implications for choosing chemotherapy? So in this particular patient, had she presented with a locally advanced disease, let's say a 3-centimeter tumor with one positive lymph node, and she was 35 years old, I think in the past, without a doubt, we would say that that woman should get chemotherapy and should then be treated with the drug tamoxifen. But I think what we're certainly seeing is that there is a group of these patients that probably have highly endocrine-sensitive tumor, perhaps that she had presented with a grade 1, highly ERPR positive, HER2 negative, oncotype recurrence score of, let's say, 5, I think we would all question whether chemotherapy might just be being a toxic way to suppress the ovaries. Now, this is still an important question, but the Taylor Rx studies do suggest that there may be a group of premenopausal or women less than the age of 50 that still don't derive benefit of chemotherapy when their recurrence scores are low. And I think this is something that we're all thinking about in our practice.
So getting back to this lady, now she's had this great response. Hopefully she'll tolerate therapy. Well, how is she tolerating the therapy? And so any issues with neutropenia?
No. So, I mean, the neutropenia that she's had is mild. It's been, you know, well tolerated. We're talking about neutrophil counts perhaps during that week off of therapy in that range of about 1,000. And after a while, you know, she's been on it for so long, we don't necessarily check a neutrophil count with each cycle. We'll check in about every 3 months with her CBC. But, you know, she really has continued to do well, excellent quality of life.
So if and when she were to develop progressive disease, first of all, how would you work her up? What kind of genomic assays would you do? And what would be treatment options, assuming she was clinically stable without visceral disease?
So I think two things. Number one is we would certainly think about doing a biopsy. And people still ask me this question of, well, is there value of doing a biopsy after you progress? And of course, in this situation, we know that there still are patients who progress where a HER2 clone can emerge, where the tumor can be estrogen receptor negative. This is uncommon, but it's common enough in an age of individualized medicine. It's certainly something that I think about. And especially at that time of first progression, where let's say in this case, the patient has been on therapy for quite some time. I think the question that we try to deal with as we think about these patients and what's running through my mind is what are those mechanisms of resistance? Certainly, we're beginning to understand that the pathway, and specifically RB, which is this gatekeeper, is critical for the activity of CDK4/6 inhibitors. And people have observed either RB loss or RB mutation as one mechanism for resistance. But we also know that certainly ESR1 mutations can be present. And we also know that these PIK3CA alterations and clones can be present either from the start or they can emerge. And so I think as the field is moving forward, what we're seeing, Neil, is that we're beginning to think about using the biopsies, not just to assess whether ER and HER2 is present, but also given the data with regard to alpelisib and PIK3CA mutations, that we should be thinking about retesting the tumor and that it may not be adequate enough to use information from that tumor that was, let's say, biopsied 3 years prior.
And for practical purposes, does that mean NGS or do you get a specific PI3 kinase assay?
Well, I think it is both. You know, I think a lot of us in practice have been doing NGS. I think not everybody. And the advantage of an NGS assay, of course, is that it can provide information potentially not only on, in this case, using alpelisib, but also potentially prompting and getting us information on future therapies down the road. I usually like to tell patients when I'm seeing them in the clinic that it's a little bit like a chess match. You want to be able to think 2 to 3 to 4 moves ahead. And so having that information can provide at least potentially some options, whether it be a clinical trial or whether it be another therapy down the road. And we can use that information to be thinking about subsequent therapies as well.
So how would you sort of think through the approach to this situation of progressive disease after a good initial response? PI3 kinase positive versus negative. Why don't we start with the negative first?
Well, I think that one of the important questions that's unanswered here is what is the activity of, if you will, second-line therapies after you progress on a CDK4/6 inhibitor? And we looked at this in our own Mayo patients recently. And what we found was actually quite sobering, and that is patients that were treated with endocrine monotherapy after progression on a CDK4/6 inhibitor had actually a very short progression-free survival, median progression-free survival of somewhere in that range of 2 to 4 months. Interestingly, if you look at data from SOLAR-1, there was a small subgroup of patients in that trial who had progressed on CDK4/6 inhibitors, and it was a very small number. But again, those patients were randomized to fulvestrant or the combination with alpelisib. And again, in that small number, the median progression-free survival, if I recall, was something around 2 months. And so one of the questions that we think about in this situation is, does endocrine monotherapy have activity in this post-CDK4/6 space? I think in the past, we would say, well, you progress on an AI, let's give you fulvestrant. We know it has activity, or we can sometimes use tamoxifen, or we can use another endocrine agent. I think what we're seeing, Neil, is that these tumors are probably rewired, and they're probably rewired in ways that we don't completely and totally understand. And so as we think about next steps, certainly in that setting where the patient does not have a PIK3CA mutation, I'm thinking about a clinical trial. Well, what about in practice? If the patient has minimal disease burden, let's say bone-only disease, I don't think it's unreasonable to use endocrine monotherapy. But one of the important questions that's unanswered here, and that is, should we continue the CDK4/6 inhibitor past progression? I'm seeing some people do this in practice. And quite honestly, I think there's some emerging preclinical data. This data is not published yet that might suggest that that might have value. There are trials that are looking at addressing this issue. Of course, this is sort of going back in time and thinking about trastuzumab all over again when we were dealing with this years ago. Should we continue trastuzumab past first progression? And I think the question is this pathway so critical that if we target other pathways, we should continue inhibition of CDK4/6? I think preclinically, I'm thinking that that may be the case, and clinically, we just have to see the data.
So prior to alpelisib coming on the scene, a lot of people talked about everolimus with exemestane, for example, after first-line endocrine therapy. Is that something you do or consider? What do we know about that after CDK4/6?
It is, and actually in the data that we presented at San Antonio last year when we looked at the outcomes of patients treated at our institution who had progressed on first-line CDK4/6 inhibitor, as I mentioned, we saw that the median progression-free survival with endocrine monotherapy, and this was, again, fulvestrant or tamoxifen, was really quite short. But interestingly, we found that patients treated with exemestane and everolimus actually did quite well. And in fact, we had in the relatively small group of patients that we were looking at, it's about 10 to 15 patients, median progression-free survival was somewhere in that range of around 10 to 12 months. So one of the questions that we'll need to understand is the mTOR pathway an important component of resistance to CDK4/6 inhibitors? And if so, if a patient progresses on a CDK4/6 inhibitor, should we be targeting that pathway? We have data, of course, coming up hopefully fairly soon from the BELIEVE study, which is essentially looking at the activity of alpelisib along with fulvestrant in patients that have progressed on a CDK4/6 inhibitor. So we'll be able to gain some data with some certainty on the activity of targeting this pathway in the post-CDK4/6 setting.
Can you talk a little bit about the data we have on alpelisib and what your experience is, both in terms of efficacy and tolerability?
Well, the data have been presented and recently published, and of course we know that this has just recently been FDA approved. What we know about alpelisib in the PIK3CA setting is that certainly it provided robust anti-tumor activity in terms of progression-free survival. We saw essentially a near doubling of progression-free survival in patients treated with alpelisib compared to fulvestrant alone. The overall survival data at this point are immature. But I think what was quite convincing from the SOLAR-1 data is this drug doesn't have activity in patients that don't have the PIK3CA mutation. And so this is truly individualized medicine, and this is really a scenario where we have to test in order to know where the pathway is activated. To me, what's really interesting, Neil, is the fact that we've known about the pathway, we've known about targeting the pathway for some time. And it's taken a while for us to finally get to this point where we have a drug, we can use it in this setting. But interestingly, the alpha-specific inhibitors, when they've been tested in the early stage setting, meaning even in the neoadjuvant setting, really have not shown a lot of activity. And of course, we know that PIK3CA mutations, when present in early stage breast cancer, are actually associated with a better prognosis. And so one of the things that's fascinating to me, of course, is that at some point, PIK3CA becomes a driver. And we know from data in the metastatic setting that when it's present in a resistant setting, this is associated with sort of very poor outcomes. For example, there was a secondary analysis of MONARCH 2 recently presented at AACR by Sarah Tulaney, where they looked at PIK3CA mutations in patients treated with fulvestrant monotherapy or the combination with abemaciclib. And those patients with the PIK3CA mutations really did quite poorly treated with endocrine monotherapy again. So clearly in that setting, in an endocrine refractory setting, having the mutation is associated with a poor prognosis. That does not necessarily mean that it's the case in the early stage setting. And so it'll be interesting to see how this drug moves forward into the earlier stage setting, and we'll await data, obviously, from those trials.
What about tolerability? You know, prior to alpelisib coming along, I was hearing a lot of negative things about PI3 kinase inhibitors, about toxicity. Then this came along and seemed like it was better, but I wasn't really clear exactly what happens.
Well, I think what we can say is that the attempts in the past to really focus on PI3 kinase have been fraught with the toxicity issues that you mentioned. And some of those toxicities actually included psychiatric issues. For example, there were some drugs that just couldn't move forward because some of those side effects, including depression and other psychiatric side effects, that were substantial to patients. What we can say is that as companies have done a better job of developing selective or alpha-selective inhibitors, that some of those issues have gone away, but we still certainly do see side effects that are unique to targeting this pathway, including, I think the big one is hyperglycemia. And with the alpelisib, the hyperglycemia is pretty substantial in a number of patients that require drugs like metformin. And so I think as clinicians begin to use these medications, there's going to be that familiarity issue. And that is, how do you deal with the hyperglycemia? When should you start metformin? Are those patients that should be started up front, or can we wait to see what type of response in terms of hyperglycemia that's going to develop? And as I think with all these drugs, I can think of the mTOR inhibitors, there's a certain comfort level that certainly comes just when you prescribe it enough and you know how to deal with these side effects. And I think clinicians will get to that point. I think the other side effects we see with alpelisib are some of the other classic side effects associated with targeting the PI3 kinase mTOR pathway, including rash, including diarrhea. And certainly it's unclear as of yet whether we'll see any issues, for example, with pneumonitis like we did with everolimus. So these will be issues that obviously once a drug gets on the market, we know about the common ones and we'll have to work out even the uncommons as well. I didn't mention the issue of stomatitis. Obviously that was a issue with the mTOR inhibitors that we've begun to use the dexamethasone mouthwash. And I think certainly we will be thinking about using that as well to help ameliorate or prevent some of those side effects as well.
Do you have any sort of general clinical experience? I don't know how many patients you've actually treated with alpelisib, but sort of how patients feel on the drug?
So I have to say that our group at Mayo was not involved in the direct development of alpelisib. We certainly have treated patients already on this drug. And what we are seeing is the side effects that really have been reported, which is the diarrhea, the rash, certainly some fatigue as well. So as we gain more, as all of us gain more confidence about using these drugs, I think we'll hopefully have a better sense really of who's at risk for the side effects and how best to deal with them.
So let's move down to the localized stage of ER-positive, HER2-negative disease. Particularly interested in your thoughts on the new data that's come out now from the TAILOR-X study that you are so much involved with that was just presented at ASCO. And maybe to get into that, we can hear about your 69-year-old lady just to sort of get started.
So this was a patient that presented a couple of years ago in my clinic. She presented with early stage breast cancer. This was a T1C breast cancer, about 1.6 centimeters. It was high grade. Estrogen and progesterone receptor were strongly positive. HER2 was negative. And she had treatment with lumpectomy and radiation therapy. And interestingly, postoperatively, we obtained a recurrence score on her. And she had actually, Neil, one of the highest recurrence scores that I've seen in my practice. She had a recurrence score of 52. And so this was a setting, a situation where having this information about the recurrence score really obviously changed how we thought about this. And perhaps, for example, in a 69-year-old female, in the past, we might have sort of tried to hem and haw and try to avoid chemotherapy. But this is one where we really felt like we were concerned that endocrine monotherapy alone is really not going to completely hold her disease back. And so we did recommend a course of adjuvant docetaxel and cyclophosphamide. And this patient really had a lot of difficulties with the docetaxel. She actually had a hypersensitivity reaction. We've all seen these in our clinic. And despite rechallenging her, actually we rechallenged her twice, we were unable to get the drug in her. And so we ended up moving on in her situation to CMF. The patient actually had a cardiac history and she was quite animate. She didn't want to be treated with an anthracycline. And so we were able to effectively deliver the oral CMF regimen, and actually she tolerated that quite well.
You know, that case really struck me because whenever you talk about recurrence score, people always think about the women who are avoiding chemotherapy. And when I saw that 52 and age 69, that was exactly what I was thinking. Probably you wouldn't have thought about chemotherapy in a patient like that, and yet seems like she would need it.
Exactly. And I think this patient was really struck as well. She was a very intelligent woman who really, she, you know, I have to laugh. I say when I sometimes see my breast cancer patients and I walk in the room that they actually know more than the trainees know about their cancer. And she certainly was one of these, was very well read, and she was quite motivated to receive adjuvant chemotherapy.
So what happened next with her?
So she actually finished the CMF chemotherapy. As I mentioned, she tolerated that quite well. And interestingly, although we don't necessarily do this in all our patients, this patient had requested a new baseline mammogram. And in fact, it had been probably about 9 months from her prior mammogram, and she came in and requested that. She was traveling from quite a ways away, and so we felt like it was potentially reasonable. And so the new mammogram, interestingly, demonstrated new calcifications. And so this prompted a biopsy, and the biopsy showed DCIS. And so she was taken to the operating room for a mastectomy. And interestingly, at the time of mastectomy, was found to have additional invasive disease that was present. So obviously this is sobering because this is a scenario where we think about where we're giving adjuvant chemotherapy to eradicate disease that we can't see. In this situation, she had just finished 6 cycles of CMF chemotherapy, and despite that, had residual invasive disease in her breast.
But she hadn't started on adjuvant endocrine therapy at that point.
She had not started on adjuvant endocrine therapy. That's correct.
It is amazing, though, that it popped up so quickly.
Yes. So she finished her treatment. She actually, at the time of surgery, she had a right skin-sparing mastectomy. Interestingly, she had some disease that also involved the muscle as well, and she had a single cluster of isolated tumor cells. And because of the nature of the disease, the involvement of the muscle, obviously, we were very concerned. We actually repeated the PET scan at that time. And interestingly, the PET scan demonstrated an area of sclerosis in one of the ribs. The question, of course, was this treated disease or not? We've gone on to treat her with an aromatase inhibitor. She's receiving zoledronic acid, and obviously we're following her very closely as she remains at high risk for developing a distant event.
What was the rationale behind the zoledronic acid? Was she osteopenic, or were you trying to prevent mets?
We really were doing it in this situation more in the adjuvant setting based on the data from, you know, the Oxford overview that demonstrates that these patients have a benefit in terms of breast cancer survival, reduction in bone metastases. So this is a patient, by the way, that previously years ago had a history of osteopenia and probably about 7 or 8 years ago had been treated with bisphosphonate. She had been off of that for many years. And so the intent here was to complete a course of treatment that would be curative.
So is that something you routinely do? And what about denosumab? We saw some data on that at ASCO.
So I think the best data here that we have about these bone-modifying agents is really with the bisphosphonates and, of course, the ones used most commonly are the aminobisphosphonates. The data with regard to denosumab, although certainly we know that that can prevent bone loss and it does it quite well, the data have yet to convincingly show that denosumab can effectively reduce breast cancer events, specifically in the bone, and also survival. So from a standpoint of using these agents in the adjuvant setting with the intent to prolong survival, prevent breast cancer morbidity and mortality, the best data that we have are with the bisphosphonates.
So I wonder, you said this patient was very proactive and involved, whether she brought up the idea of either getting a CDK inhibitor off trial or participating in a trial. Where are we right now with adjuvant CDK inhibitors, and when are we going to see some answers?
Well, some of the large adjuvant CDK4/6 inhibitor trials have already completed enrollment. For example, the PALLAS trial, which is a trial that examined the role of palbociclib in women with ER-positive breast cancer that had been treated with curative intent. And in that trial, patients are randomized to either palbociclib or just standard endocrine therapy. All women, of course, in this trial get standard endocrine approaches. And in the MONARCH E study, this was a trial evaluating abemaciclib, a little bit higher risk population, patients with locally advanced breast cancer, as well as a subset in the MONARCH E that have high levels of Ki-67, again, looking to see whether abemaciclib, when added to standard endocrine therapy, can improve invasive disease-free survival. And of course, there's data in studies ongoing in the adjuvant space with ribociclib, and those trials have either completed accrual or will be close to completing accrual soon. So to answer your question, I think, when are we going to see the data? I expect probably in that range of perhaps 2021 when we would begin to potentially begin to see the data mature.
What do we know about the issue of immunity in breast cancer, but specifically with CDK4/6 inhibitors? And what about the strategy of combining them with checkpoint inhibitors?
So this is one of the interesting things about CDK4/6 inhibitors that has really just emerged just recently. And in fact, sometimes I find that when I look at a drug that works extremely well, and I'm thinking about the drug trastuzumab, when that drug was first developed, we all thought, well, this drug is simply inhibiting HER2 and in the downstream pathways. But as it turns out, the drug has profound effects on the immune system and specifically on ADCC. So it's not unsurprising that we look at CDK4/6 inhibitors and we see them working so well that we might find additional mechanisms by which these drugs work. And in fact, in some ways, it makes sense. I think the issue of the immune effects, what's been observed, Neil, is that in preclinical models, these drugs have effect on things such as Tregs. And Tregs, we know, are important as it relates to developing of resistance to standard chemotherapy, associating with early recurrences. And there have been really not a lot of dedicated strategies that we have at targeting Tregs. And the observations were that simply by inhibiting CDK4/6, that you could have some effects preclinically in a number of these different models, both in mouse models, as well as seen in patients potentially on these immune subsets or these immune cells, the Tregs. So I think that we don't completely know or understand exactly how these drugs affect the immune system to some extent, other than the observations that there does appear some effects on the immune system. There was a paper that was published by Sham Gul in Nature about 2 years ago that really outlined for the first time the potential immune effects of CDK4/6 inhibitors. And what this has prompted people to think about is to say, well, if that's the case, would there be value of combining, in this case, a CDK4/6 inhibitor along with checkpoint therapy? And in fact, in some of the preclinical models, there was a suggestion indeed that there was synergy in an ER-positive breast cancer model combining a CDK4/6 inhibitor along with checkpoint therapy. So what we can say is that those trials are ongoing. We don't have necessarily randomized data as of yet. What we can say is that we are obviously concerned about the possibility for the side effects which we know can occur when you use a checkpoint inhibitor, and along with the side effects that occur with CDK4/6, and is this going to be a tolerable approach? The data combining abemaciclib along with a checkpoint inhibitor, pembrolizumab, those are really single-arm data, but I would say they certainly do look interesting, but the real question is, will this be a tolerable approach? The other thing I think is really important, and that is, as breast cancer oncologists, we certainly have not thought about estrogen receptor positive breast cancers being immunogenic. We think about triple negative breast cancer, we think about HER2 positive breast cancer. And in general, when we think about ER positive breast cancer, I think of these cancers as sort of flying under the radar of the immune system. Think about a lobular breast cancer. These are genomically quiet, they don't tend to have a lot of mutations. And so I do think that there's going to be emerging work and attempts to really define a subset of ER-positive breast cancers that may be immunogenic. And I think we can only look at, thinking out loud here, the data from I-SPY 2 that was recently presented, well, within the last almost 2 years by Rita Nanda, where they looked at the role of pembrolizumab in the I-SPY 2 trial, where you saw that pembrolizumab improved path CR rates, but it was not just in triple negative, but it was also in the ER positive. And just to be clear, patients to get onto I-SPY 2 had to be high by mammoprint. So they had to have this high risk assay suggesting a higher risk for recurrence. And so there probably is a subset of ER positive breast cancers that we might think about that not only may be immunogenic, but maybe responsive to estrogen targeted therapies along with immune strategies. And certainly this is going to be an area of great research, and look forward to seeing these data moving forward.
So speaking of waiting for big trials to accrue, actually, George Sledge was showing me a picture of a water bottle. We did this display at San Antonio, I think, in 2008 of ongoing trials. And we actually had a water bottle with the Taylor X study when it was just getting started. Can you talk about that study that you've been so involved with, and particularly the data that was just presented at ASCO?
So the Taylor X data that we're familiar with and that has been so widely disseminated and talked about really, as we know, is took any woman who had ER-positive breast cancer. Just to clarify, there were both pre- and postmenopausal women in that study. And the study really examined this group of patients with a so-called intermediate recurrence score between 11 to 25. And these are patients that we really didn't completely know or understand, did chemotherapy add to the outcomes or add to improve the outcomes for these patients. And in the TAILOR-RX study, patients with low recurrence scores were treated with endocrine monotherapy. Patients with a high recurrence score were treated with standard chemotherapy followed by endocrine therapy. And then this intermediate group was, of course, the subject of randomization. And as was presented originally over a year ago, we know that overall there was no benefit of chemotherapy in this intermediate group. But I think the more recent data, which has been quite interesting, that was published by Joe Sperano in the New England Journal of Medicine and recently presented at ASCO, looked at this issue of clinical risk. And I think this is, of course, something that we've been waiting for some time, because when we see a recurrence score on a given patient and we think about the benefit or lack of benefit, we sort of see data without information about the clinical characteristics. And as we think about these genomic assays, it's been pretty clear that the clinical characteristics still matter. So as we look at something, for example, like the EP assay or EndoPredict assay, one of the things that has been shown is that you get a much more robust sense of the value of that assay when you bring in the clinical factors. And indeed, this is really the analysis from the TAILOR-RX study, is that, first of all, that clinical risk does matter. And so, for example, if you have a small tumor, let's say less than 1 centimeter, low grade, that the implications in terms of the risk for a late disease event, that clinical risk still matters despite your genomic data. What was important to note, however, was despite looking at these varying different clinical risks, that in postmenopausal women, that there was still no value of giving chemotherapy whether you had sort of high clinical risk or low clinical risk. And that is, so if you had a 65-year-old woman that had more high clinical risk features, larger tumor, we could still say with confidence that chemotherapy was not having value. What was interesting, however, was looking at the premenopausal women, Neil, and that is that there appears to be something different about premenopausal women. And I think one of the caveats about interpreting the TAILOR-RX data in the premenopausal setting is that these patients were enrolling at a time when most of them were getting tamoxifen monotherapy. In fact, about 85% or so received tamoxifen monotherapy. So we know that today that just giving proper endocrine therapy, that would be adding ovarian function suppression, and in some patients even adding in an AI, that actually gives you a large delta, a large benefit. And so knowing the history of the fact that chemotherapy-induced amenorrhea is an important prognostic factor, what we don't know in this situation is how much did chemotherapy-associated amenorrhea impact the outcomes of these patients. That being said, it's pretty clear that there is a subgroup of patients within the intermediate group, perhaps in that 16 to 20 and 20 to 25 range, that appear with high clinical risk to be benefiting from chemotherapy. We can only surmise at this point, is it because of the chemotherapy effects on the ovaries, or is it something unrelated? And one of the things that I'm kind of interested about, Neil, is the fact that we have patients who are premenopausal who are more likely to have pathogenic mutations in something like a BRCA1 or a BRCA2 gene. And we know already that deficiencies in DNA repair confer chemotherapy benefit in some of these patients. So I think a question is, are they benefiting because we're ablating their ovaries, or is it just that chemotherapy works better in these younger patients? And I think that's an unanswered question, but certainly these are provocative data.
That's interesting. I hadn't really thought it. When I think about DNA repair, I think about platinums. But do you think that applies to chemotherapy in general?
I think it does. And, you know, I think the idea here is to say that, you know, for example, when one utilizes a regimen such as docetaxel and cyclophosphamide, when you're using a drug that targets DNA like cyclophosphamide, or obviously the classic one are the anthracyclines, we know that these drugs do benefit patients with DNA repair deficiencies. We think, obviously, that platinums might be the optimal way to go, but we actually don't have, if you will, level one data that we should choose a platinum over our standard therapies. And so I think a question moving forward in the TAILORx study, especially in these young premenopausal women, is the benefit that we're seeing perhaps restricted to certain types of patients? I don't think we know the answer to that, but I think there's an interest in looking at that moving forward.
So getting back to these recent data, looking at clinical factors, the one that seemed to strike me as being very common, as you mentioned, was size. And I think it was 3 centimeters that sort of was the breaking point. But does that mean for you it's biology, not anatomy? I mean, 4 and 5 centimeters, are you still in a postmenopausal woman comfortable not using chemotherapy in an intermediate score?
I think I'm quite confident about not using chemotherapy in that postmenopausal woman. I think what we can say is that risk does not always confer benefit from our therapies. What's pretty clear is that, and as we look at TAILORx, but not only that, but the recent Oxford overview with regard to the late recurrence outcomes that were published a few years ago, that these clinical characteristics have implications with regard to risk for recurrence. So I like to think of it this way, is that you know, higher disease burden, a larger tumor nodal status certainly imparts a higher risk for distant metastases, but does not necessarily give me input necessarily that those patients, at least based on TAILORx, I can confidently say that our best approach right now needs to be to deliver better targeted therapies focused on the estrogen receptor for those patients as opposed to chemotherapy. And the nice thing about this, and when I speak to patients in the clinic, I like to think of it this way, very simplistically. We have types of breast cancers where targeting the estrogen receptor leads to excellent long-term outcomes, and we're very confident, for example, based on TAILORx, that we can focus on estrogen targeting therapies. And then we have these patients with the higher recurrence score patient I just mentioned, where we're actually quite concerned that endocrine therapy alone is really not going to have substantial effects on inhibiting the growth of presumed micrometastatic disease.
You were mentioning other genomic assays. You were talking about EndoPredict, of course, the 70 gene assays out there. It seemed like we were talking more about those a few years ago. Now, maybe it's because the TAILORx study came out. It seems like most of the discussion is more centered around the recurrence score. But what do we know? We talked earlier about sometimes you have a bunch of alternatives, but yet there's more data with one. Do you think there's a fundamental difference in what they're looking at? What do we know about, you know, these studies that have looked at the same assay or different assays in the same patient? And in terms of clinical utilization, is there a role for any of the others?
Well, I think that what's pretty clear is that all of these assays provide robust prognostic information. And if you look at one of the common denominators across these assays, it's that they measure proliferation. So without a doubt, if I wanted simply an assay that would give me prognostic information, I really could choose a number of these assays. But really, the question that a lot of us face is this issue of clinical utility. And that is, what should I do with the information? And I think that's where data with regard to the recurrence score has been most helpful in terms of providing help with decision-making for clinicians. And that is, I can really confidently say that, okay, based on this result and based on the prospective data from TAILORx, I don't need to give chemotherapy in this situation. I think one of the other issues that's really untapped, and untapped meaning we need more information, and that is the role of these assays in looking at the risk for long-term recurrence, as well as the benefit of long-term endocrine strategies, that is, utilizing endocrine therapy in that years 5 through 10. And again, we have some data with some suggesting that they may be prognostic for late recurrence. And we also have some data from the so-called breast cancer index that combines a 5-gene assay, which is more of the proliferation part, with the so-called HOXB13 IL-17. And that assay really suggests that there may be a group of patients not only at higher risk for late recurrence, but perhaps who may benefit from extended therapy.
So one of the other talks that I saw that you gave that I was interested in actually focused on that and the issue of dormancy. I'm just kind of curious, what's your hypothesis about sort of the biology of late recurrence?
Well, this is really a hot topic, and I think it's a hot topic, Neil, because we've been successful with our early strategies, or we've been successful at reducing early recurrences. If we weren't successful in reducing early recurrences, we wouldn't be worried about late recurrences. But the reality is we've gotten much better, and we've started discharging these patients from our clinic, lo and behold, to see them come back 10, 15, 20 years. And I always tell audiences that the latest recurrence I've ever seen was in a Mayo Clinic breast cancer patient who had a 40-year relapse.
Wow.
And it was an interesting scenario where she had had a bilateral mastectomy in 1970 and was being treated by our hematologist for her CLL, when all of a sudden her anemia really, if you will, her cytopenias really increased dramatically, much more problems with anemia, requiring blood transfusions, prompting a bone marrow, and lo and behold, finding not necessarily that CLL had progressed, but finding breast cancer cells that had taken over the bone marrow. So we do see these late recurrences, and as I mentioned, it's because we've been successful, I think, in part by treating some of the early recurrences. This idea of tumor dormancy is an interesting one because the suggestion is that we know that there are breast cancer cells, these cells that are going out sometimes, and I think about them as spreading long before, you know, they ever come to my office. And we know that these cells can be in an equilibrium, so-called, with their microenvironment, such that they're not causing problems. We know that we can inhibit the growth of them with drugs like tamoxifen, and we can certainly eradicate some of these micrometastases with our chemotherapy agents. But we also know that these micrometastases can be present for many, many years. And in fact, there's probably many patients that are dying of things other than breast cancer with micrometastases present in a dormant state where they're just not causing problems. So the interesting issue, of course, and that is who is at risk for developing late recurrence and which of our patients have these dormant cells, A, that would never cause problems and we should actually leave them alone, and B, those that are actually going to cause problems down the road. What are the host factors, the genetic factors, the microenvironments, the immune factors that would all potentially be driving the reemergence of these and causing these dormant cells to sort of no longer be dormant, but to be actively growing? So this is certainly an area that is of great interest. One of the things that people have started thinking about, of course, is can we utilize these very sensitive assays such as circulating tumor cells or circulating tumor DNA to pick up and identify patients early, and perhaps by doing that, prevent some of the morbidity that occurs with breast cancer. And of course, these assays are out there. We know that they're reproducible, but we're trying to find utility for them.
So interesting. I was just flashing on your patient with a 40-year later recurrence who had CLL. And I was curious, did you get a BTK inhibitor, venetoclax, and how that would have affected the breast cancer? So fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, this particular patient really had a quite virulent course after the diagnosis of breast cancer. She had really been observed with regard to her CLL, and it was the observations, you know, her CLL was quite indolent, and she hadn't reached the point where her hematologists were even treating her, but it was a change in her CBC that prompted the workup. And she was treated at that time, you know, initially with endocrine therapy. This is prior to CDK4/6 inhibitors, you know, moving through to chemotherapies, and unfortunately had a fairly rapid course.
Yeah, it was a case sent in to me from a doc in practice of a patient with marrow disease who was also ER positive, HER2 negative. I was kind of curious which CDK inhibitor you would give. This patient started out on palbo, and their neutropenia got even worse. Would you, in that situation, use Abema?
I think I would, because in that situation, knowing that the patient, let's say, already has problems with cytopenias and knowing that we're going to probably run into some problems, I think that would be a situation where I would think of abemaciclib definitely first.